Recapping 2020, three pieces of good news. This is The Week on Wednesday. Hello and welcome to The Week on Wednesday. I am your host, Ben Davison, and with me, as always, is the lovely, the fantastic Guardian columnist extraordinaire and world-renowned socialist, Van Badham. And, of course, Germanicus is splooting on the floor of our garage. This is the final episode of The Week on Wednesday for the year 2020.
We're going to take a two-week break, which is very well deserved. Ben has had a big year.
I think we've all had a big year in 2020, Van. And, Van, so tell us, 2020, what's this year just been about?
Well, obviously, the year has been dominated by the pandemic. This has been a worldwide phenomenon. The world's seen nothing like it since the influenza epidemic of 1918. And it's also been interesting to sort of reflect on perhaps why we don't know more about the pandemic of 1918, because it's been kind of excruciating, Ben, wouldn't you say?
Oh, it's been a horrendous year in so many ways, and so many people have just made so many poor decisions that has compounded the horror show that has been COVID-19, whether it's here in the US, the UK, Brazil, of course, is still in huge amounts of trouble. But, you know, I think some of the things we've learned here in Australia in 2020 have been things like how important shelf stackers really are, how important our healthcare workers are, the differences between privatised and publicly owned facilities and services, and of course, the actual primacy of premiers, which, when you think about it, was what the founders of our federation had originally intended.
It has been really interesting. We're not going to focus on the numbers today because I'm sure other news sources are going to do that. We know that there have been close to 1.5 million deaths throughout the world. Obviously, they hit the 300,000 death mark in America. In Australia, we've been relatively lucky, like less than 1,000 deaths, but we did see so many of those concentrated in the privatised aged care system that Ben is quite right. This has provoked enormous conversations about how we constitute society and how our economy is or is not resilient to crisis. Ben, what have been your big insights of the economic impacts of COVID-19?
Well, I think what we've seen is how important it is to make sure that working people have not just money in their pockets to spend in a domestic economy, but also the confidence that secure work and job security provides them. So we've seen in so many circumstances where an outbreak has taken off, that it has originated in a workplace where those workers have had insecure work. They've been casual, they've been labour hire, they've been unable to confidently take time off to recover from an illness or to get tested. And as a result, a sniffle is ignored, COVID starts to bloom, and it spreads to other people.
And this was certainly the case with the hotel quarantine situation in Victoria. And not to mention the recent outbreak in South Australia was a guy from a quarantine hotel who had a second job in a pizzeria.
And it just amazes me that we know all this is a problem. We can see it. And obviously it's worse in some other places. But we know it's a problem. The Victorian government and the Queensland government have both acted to cut off this problem at the source. They've provided payments to people to go and get tested. They've provided payments to people who are in insecure work, who need to isolate or can't go to work because of COVID or COVID testing. So this is not an unknown issue, but like so many things, it's not about facts or data-driven decision-making with the conservative side of politics. It's about ideology. So many times, Van, people have said to you and I, if only they understood the truth, if only Morrison and his cronies could see the data or understand the data, as though somehow or another these highly educated people can't understand the basic facts that all the rest of us understand, and somehow or another they're blind to the reality. It's not that they're blind to it, it's that they choose not to take the lessons. They choose not to apply the information. They choose to adhere to an ideology that dismisses the value, not just of the work that people in insecure work do, but really of the lives of those people and their impact on our community. We saw Stephen Marshall try and turn the guns on that insecure worker.
Oh, it was outrageous. And Stephen Marshall is the Premier of South Australia. I don't expect you to have heard from him if you're not from there. And not really a memorable character.
And I think the most memorable thing that I've heard out of South Australia was when he was looking at ways to, and I quote, punish the worker who went to work when they were sick because they had no choice. They had no choice. You know, it's always worth remembering that in our country, not only do casual workers have little choice but to turn up to work when they're sick because of the financial implications of not coming to work? But even if you're a full-time worker, your employer can order you to come to work. And if you refuse, that can be seen as a form of illegal and unlawful industrial action. Now, obviously, if you're a full-time worker or you're an ongoing worker, you have access to sick leave and some protections there as well. But this is not a country that has empowered working people in the way that maybe sometimes we like to think. And I think one of the things that I've taken out of COVID 2020, if you like, is that the weaknesses in our industrial relations system, the weaknesses or the imbalance, if you like, in the power relationship between large corporations, to a degree government as well, and working people are really, really stark. And it'd be good to see in 2021, rather than that ominous omnibus IR bill that we've talked about quite a bit recently, we actually get some laws that improve conditions for casuals, put in place a proper safety net that nobody can fall through just because they're casual or labour hire, and to protect us all right across the community from things like pandemics, from things like a really bad batch of influenza, whatever it might be that comes along.
A climate change disaster.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's another thing that I think 2020 has shown as well, is that climate change is an issue not just because it's an environmental issue, but because it's a jobs issue. It's an employment issue. You know, Morrison has failed the working people of this country, not just now, but into the future. Now, certainly because of failing to address the environmental impacts of climate change. And we see wild weather right across the country, whether it's really hot or really cold, whether it's crazy winds or
floods,
crazy rains,
fires, storms.
You know, but we're also starting to see the impacts on what the future of work will be in this country. You know, we're starting to see the United States putting in place trillions of dollars of investment to create the jobs of the future. We're starting to see the European Union and the UK talk about carbon tariffs on Australian exports. You know, those countries, those trading blocks are moving in a direction that's about a clean energy future with jobs of the future, and yet the Morrison government is failing to address any of those things.
I think this is one of the big stories of 2020 is, I mean, I found it so alarming and disappointing as an Australian that there is a massive international climate action conference taking place that's following in the spirit of the Paris Climate Agreement and looking at collaboration and getting the world economy down to net zero. And Australia is on a list of countries with Russia and Saudi Arabia, was not invited to speak because this country is not making a meaningful contribution to solving this collective problem. And the thing is that people have been warning this particular government, I mean, we've had Liberal government in this country since 2013, have been warning the government since that time about a need to prepare the economy. And I know you say I'm obsessed with American politics, and this is entirely true. But when Joe Biden got up in the presidential debates and when, you know, people say climate change, I say jobs, let's build the jobs of the future, I see limitless opportunity, you know, the idea that that message was powerful enough to carry a state like Pennsylvania for Biden in the US election. Pennsylvania is a fossil fuel community state. The Democrats have made huge inroads in places like Texas as well, which is, you know, the home of the American oil industry, that the world is definitely moving in a different direction, looking at, you know, how are we preparing our economies? What are we doing about jobs? How can we create opportunity? And yet Morrison's stuck in the past.
And it really is a kind of past that doesn't never really quite hit the peaks that they promised as well. You know, it was a past that promised free trade and people would buy our coal forever. And of course, we're seeing now people not buying our coal.
People are not buying our coal, Ben.
And it's this sort of over-reliance on a free trade model that doesn't take into account the needs of people, and assuming that every government will continue to act in quote-unquote the best economic interest of its people, even when its people say, we don't want that. That's not actually in our interest. And the reality is we're seeing now China's not doing that. We're seeing China go, we're going to use Chinese coal. We're not going to use Australian coal.
At the same time, the Chinese are massively investing in renewables.
Absolutely.
And solar in particular.
And, you know, and it's right across the board when it comes to this. So, you know, the point of the nation state is to look after the people within the nation state, right? And so if you're prioritising forms of trade that are not part of the people's best interest, then you're going to have a problem. And we do. We have a huge problem here. And it's got to do with coal. It's got to do with beef. It's got to do with...
Barley.
Barley. It's got to do...
wine.
With wine and fishing products. And the reality of it
is... the kind of primary production which keeps regional economies alive.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we saw today Adam Crichton has called on Australia to ban students from particular countries as part of some kind of trade war. Now, this is
Adam Crichton, of course, who said that he would be perfectly prepared to sacrifice his own father to COVID-19 if the wheels of the economy kept running.
Yeah, he's an Australian economics editor. And, you know, this is the kind of craziness that the Confederacy in the Civil War engaged in, right, where they said, we're not going to sell cotton to England and France until they come and help us beat the North. And England and France went, well, then we'll use cotton and wool from elsewhere, right? And suddenly the Confederacy found itself with no money, no allies and...
No nothing,
trying to fight a war. Now, for the economic...
140 years later, they're still fighting.
Yeah, and for the economic so-called rationalists in Australia to think that, oh, well, we can ignore the rest of the world when it comes to issues like climate change, like geopolitical issues, like what's in the best... like countries acting in the best interests of their people, and just think that people will buy our stuff no matter what, is so naive. And then to flip it on its head entirely and say, well, we're going to punish them by not selling them the things that generate income for our country.
Is, take that, China.
Like, it's just total madness. It's like saying, I'm not going to pay my power bill to teach the power company a lesson. Well, they just get cut off. You just end up sitting in the dark. And the real worry I have about the Morrison government now is that it's a failure to embrace reality and it's a failure to adjust to the new post-COVID realities of the world, and we all end up sitting in the dark.
Well, I think there's a really great image that sums up the failure to address reality from the Morrison government. And, of course, you and I have spoken on this show before about Morrison's working-class drag, like that he's offered the footy, sinking beers, and this sort of affected accent that he does, and daggy dad, chicken coop kind of... these sort of PR visual missions. An image appeared on Twitter this week of Matt Canavan, your favourite person. Ben just loves Matt Canavan and just thinks he's a shining example of everything going wrong in Australia. And Canavan is, of course, from the National Party and the self-appointed representative of the coal industry. He actually said that as a senator, his job was to represent the coal industry. Spoiler alert, Matt, you're actually supposed to represent the people of Queensland. But he was wearing high vis, as you do, in a working class drag situation, and he had a dusting of coal dust across his face. Now, Ben knows, our listeners may not, that I have actually worked in the coal industry and I'm from the town of Wollongong, which is, you know, coal mining community. And of course, if you were actually in a coal mine, you would have rather a lot of protective equipment on. And somebody did post an image of what a real coal miner looks like. And of course, they don't have a gentle sprinkling of coal dust around their eyes because they're wearing protective equipment that prevents coal dust.
They don't have it rubbed over their mouth like Canavan.
Oh, it was just unbelievable. And for me, I was just like, this is enraging. Like, this is a failure to address reality. This is an unwillingness to even represent reality. This is playing dress-ups in order to, you know, badge and signify that, you know, like, we care about jobs and we care about coal communities. It's the most nakedly cynical political garbage I've seen in this country for some time.
And it's consistent with what we've seen right across the world in 2020, that there are some governments that are prepared to face the reality, no matter how hard it might be, and engage with people honestly about that, put in place programs that will deal with the impacts of those realities. And there are some people in some governments that are simply not prepared to accept that things change, that there are negative things that go on, and that they need to front up to people about it. Now, you can kind of understand why. Not everybody is prepared to accept that there are negative things in the world. They like to live in a fantasy world, and you can see that every time there's a Trump rally and there's 10,000 people crammed shoulder to shoulder screaming and spitting in each other's faces without masks on during a pandemic, right? But you have to have governments prepared to do something? And one of the other lessons of 2020 is that the Morrison government has relied really heavily on the state premiers and the state governments to prop it up. You know, despite all the Morrison attacks on Queensland for not opening its borders and WA for not opening their borders.
And the relentless attacks on Daniel Andrews.
The reality would be that without the state premiers doing what they did during the pandemic, there would have been a huge outbreak and Scott Morrison's government would be suffering the same kind of instability that's now afflicting the Johnson government in the UK and may well have toppled in the same way that the Trump government has in the US. So this is a Commonwealth government that relies on and has relied on, despite its attacks, despite its attempts to undermine them in some ways, the stability of the states and the willingness of the states to make the hard decisions in order to keep it afloat.
And actually do the practical work. I find it really interesting as a political tactic. Like, I think it was quite obvious that there were no ideas in the ideological policy cupboard for the Morrison government. They had to be pushed by the trade union movement to bring in JobKeeper. Like, that was a trade union campaign.
Well, they sent a million people to the job queues outside Centrelink before they were prepared to do that. It took nights and nights of footage of people lining up
around the blocks. And so they had to be pushed by the trade union movement to do that. Of course, we know that the Morrison government has been putting salary caps and all kinds of screws down on the public service, and they love a bit of outsourcing and they love cutting those kind of resources. And yet when it came down to the crunch, like, they relied on the very things that they hate to hold the whole ship together. That was effective and efficient public service bureaucracies, being able to run the logistics of managing the crisis. Obviously, JobKeeper and the increase to JobSeeker kept the economy ticking over. Like, all of these things actually were ideas from other people. They didn't have the commitment to the ideas of maintaining the collective good. That's not where they come from ideologically. And of course, the political tactic was to outsource everything to the state governments and then relentlessly hammer the state governments. They were the ultimate armchair critics.
Well, really, we had the Commonwealth government acting as though it were an opposition to state governments this year, throughout the year.
That's a very good insight, Ben. I might put that in the column.
And what we need to see in 2021 is a federal opposition that will take on the Commonwealth, because the Commonwealth has now been forced to come up with its own, in inverted commas, ideas. And what we've seen, of course, is the ominous omnibus IR bill, Work Choices 2.0, which is just reheating the same old tired, failed ideas of the past. And that's actually all the Morrison government has. We're seeing attacks on the ABC. We're seeing attacks on working people.
We're seeing $10 million donations to Richard Pratt, the richest man in Australia, in order to build a new paper mill, I believe.
Well, that's right. Using money from the Bushfire Recovery Fund, when there are people whose houses and homes have been burned to the ground, living in tents, but Australia's richest man gets $10 million. This is corporate welfare, you know, and we've seen that. That's what the Commonwealth budget, Morrison's Commonwealth budget, was about, more corporate welfare. We've had lots of conversations with small business people in our community who said, look, the instant asset write-off was great when it first came in. We've tapped out. We've used it. We don't need more assets. We need people who've got skills. We need people to spend money in our community. We need people to feel confident and secure.
We need an economic plan.
You know, we're seeing people locally going, I'm not using subcontractors anymore. I'm hiring people. They're making that choice, even though it costs them probably slightly more, because it creates more stability within their own small market. Now, when you've got small business people making those kinds of decisions in local communities, and a Commonwealth government still insisting on this kind of outdated Thatcherite 1980s economic rationalism, there's a real conflict here. And I think there's a real opportunity for Labor in 2021 to go, Morrison promised cattle farmers that you'd have more markets to sell cattle. He has failed. He promised wine growers you'd have more markets to sell wine. He has failed. He promised small business people you'd have more customers domestically for your products. He has failed. Morrison is failing the people of Australia across so many different segments. He's failed pensioners and retirees as interest rates have collapsed. What's he done? He's attacked superannuation. They're fighting.
Oh, he's attacked industry superannuation. Oh,
of course. And they're fighting
the superannuation controlled by working people, Ben.
He's fighting old ideological political wars rather than focusing on what people need. So look, I think in 2020, the tactic of being an opposition from Commonwealth government against the states has worked for Morrison to some degree.
I don't think we can argue that it hasn't worked at all, because I think it has. Morrison's very popular.
But I think in 2021, what we're going to have to see is a Commonwealth opposition, i.e. Labor, minor parties as well, standing up to Morrison and highlighting these ideological, deeply political agendas and how it's failing Australian people.
Well, this is the thing. And I mean, you and I have had this discussion many times about what's the tactic from here, because Morrison's game, of course, is to do all of his public appearances. And he actually deploys his cabinet foot soldiers, Christian Porter, Josh Frydenberg, Alan Tudge, to do the actual the policy work and the policy announcements. And we know that these guys are radical neoliberals. Like, Christian Porter's vision for IR in this country is not fair, it's not equitable, it's not empowering, it's literally terrifying. Like, it's based on essentially, it's that, I might have mentioned this last week, but I think about it all the time, you know, the people who are opposed to minimum wage are the people who would pay you nothing if they thought they could get away with it. And certainly, like, we already live in an extremely legally restricted IR environment. We're taking strike action is near impossible. Mm. You know, the old days of wildcat strikes and on-the-job industrial action are long gone, because they've been legislated into a reality of fines, and more fines. Mm. And yet they want to go harder. They want to create more instabilities for workers. They want to restrict union rights even further. But that's being done by Porter, an individual who the vast majority of Australians wouldn't be able to pick out of a lineup. Mm. At the same time, Morrison represents himself as your daggy dad, who gives you the opportunity of not having to think about politics. You can think about bar A classes and curries and, you know, the footy and whatever. And it is really important, because we've said before, an opposition can't do that. Albo can't dress up as Santa and pretend he's at every local mall. You know, you can't do the cutesy things in opposition, she said, getting so emotional she slapped her hand into a lighting pole. But what you can do in opposition is you can, you know, I don't understand why Labor didn't look at what happened with Tony Abbott and go, that's the model. Next time we're in opposition, we're going to do to them what they did to us. Because what Tony Abbott did so successfully was hammer the issues, and create this sense of chaos around a Labor government that was not actually chaotic until it became chaotic.
Well, it's also about realising that from opposition, your ability to dominate the agenda is really limited. Mm. And what you've got to do is actually point out the failings of government and not be so hung up on whether, when you talk about the failure of the Morrison government to help cattle farmers sell their beef, or fishing communities to sell lobsters and fish, or whatever it might be, but, you know, farming communities to sell barley.
Universities to sell degrees.
You've got to somehow or another be offering up an entirely different vision or fully thought through policy position. What you need to do is highlight that there's a problem to start with and give people some confidence that you understand that it's a problem, that you understand that it's an issue for them, it's an issue for money in their pocket, it's an issue for the jobs in their community. You know, we live in a community where there are lots of people who grow beef. They don't export. There's not a lot of exporters around here, but they are concerned that if the export markets for Australian beef shrink, what that will do to beef markets in Australia more broadly.
Will flood the local market.
And then you end up with price crashes and job losses and less money in the local economy, and you have these kind of negative spiral effects, right? So there's a lot of insecurity that flows from this. And the role of government is to reassure people that things are under control, that policies are in place to deal with these issues, that the policy settings that we have will increase your wealth, increase your security, increase your health, and give you better opportunities in the future. That's the fundamental sort of thing. So for the opposition to feel like they've got to fully explain how they're going to do all those things before they can talk about the problems that exist and that are impacting people now.
It's a discursive spaghetti.
It becomes too much, right? People don't want to think about politics that
discursive
much.
Discursive spaghetti. It's a lovely term. Thank you. It's discursive spaghetti, everyone.
And this is what Morrison's tapped into, as you say. He's tapped into the fact that people don't want to think about politics, right? They just want to have that sense of confidence that it's taken care of.
That somebody else is in charge.
And if the Prime Minister's off building chicken coops and at the footy, then the reality must be that everything's okay.
Well,
but
I mean,
it's not.
The thing that I find really frustrating with the Labor Party is there's been a consistent failure to address the traps that are set by conservative media. So the Labor Party feels this obligation to have, in opposition, these crazy detailed policy positions, because the habit of conservative media is like, what's Labor going to do about it?
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
I see you've had this position on blah, 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 blah. And there's a confusion between... I mean, obviously the answer to that question is, well, when we're in government, we're going to have a full review involving all stakeholders and committed to X core principles.
When we're in government, we'll do the work of government. When we're in opposition, we'll do the work of opposition.
Yeah, you know, and
we'll
the work
do the
of opposition
job that we've
is,
got now.
Why are you asking me for a detailed policy position on this when we are not actually in government? We don't have access to the resources of government to actually, you know, research the detail of the policy positions. And we watch insiders. You and I watch insiders, and we watch Labor people fall for it every time. Every time.
And part of it too is because on the left of politics, we like to think that we. Across the issues, we're engaging in policy, we understand politics, we want to make sure that we're constantly doing...
You and some policy detail.
We're doing the work, right? Like that's sort of... I've heard people say, we're doing the work, we're doing the work. And I get that. I get the desire to want to do that. I want to do that too. But doing the work without actually having the job makes you a crazy person. Like it does. It does. You can't turn up to a factory and start trying to do work on a production line if you don't work there. They'd just have you arrested, right? So this idea that when David Spears or somebody from the left says, well, what's Labor's policy on emissions reduction, you know, between now and 2035, somehow or another we've got to have the 200-page document that spells out exactly all the adjustments of the economy.
Something that is never demanded at the Liberal Party, even when they're in government.
And how we're going to transition communities and how we're going to, you know, how many megawatts of solar and how many megawatts of wind and how many megawatts of offshore and versus how many megawatts of gas. The idea that we have to have that document and we have to be able to speak to it authoritatively, because that's what people on the left want. Like, I get that that's what people on the left want. If you want that, elect a government that's going to do that work. Don't work towards undermining an opposition, trying to get rid of a government that refuses to do it. Help an opposition that says, look, we'll do that work, but you've got to give us the job.
Well, I mean, this is the thing. One of the other great political moments, terrifying political moments for me this year was Richard Colbeck, who's the Minister for Aged Care.
Yeah.
And, like, aged care is where the majority of coronavirus deaths have been in Australia, in the privatised aged care system. This is been a huge like flaw in our healthcare and services provision. It's been a disaster. We know that there's been a problem in aged care for years and years and years since the big privatisation started.
Yeah.
And he was asked how many people had died and couldn't give an answer. He's the minister. And yet you see...
And let's be clear, he wasn't ambushed with it. It wasn't at some doorstop. It was a committee meeting that he had been prepared for, that he had the department there with him. Like this is part
business
and
of government stuff
of his job.
Yeah.
Right?
And he couldn't answer that question, part and parcel of his job in a formal parliamentary process with the full resources of government. And yet, again and again on Insiders, well, Labor, what are you going to do about the price of tin cans in 2077? Like,
you know, if somebody asked me to paint their fence and said, look, I want you to paint the fence. I've got three other blokes painting the other three fences that go around my property. And I'll decide at the end of that process which one of you I'll pay to paint the whole fence, I'd just look at them and go, are you a lunatic? Like, we have to, as an electorate, not be lunatics. We have to not expect political parties to do the job that they're not actually employed to do. And we have to hold those who are employed to do it, those ministers, you know, if I said to somebody, I want you to paint all four of my fences, here's your money, off you go, and they disappeared and didn't turn up for 6 months, right? And I kept going, why haven't you painted my fence? And they kept going, well, I'll have to take that on notice. I would be going to the police.
It's another thing as well that I think that there's a confusion between what happens in Canberra and what happens with the people. I'm quite sure I'm not the first person to say this, but it's something that I've noticed particularly this year that Labor has some people in the federal caucus who are excellent interrogators, who are people like Katie Gallagher, who are really across the detail of the questions that they ask in these parliamentary committees and Senate inquiries and things. And Katie Gallagher is a really good example because she asks these questions that strip away the kind of garbage that the government go on with, the obfuscations, you know, the things that they don't want to acknowledge. But there seems to be this confusion in the Labor messaging that what is obviously a thunderous victory in a committee setting is not a thunderous victory in terms of political communication. Like the nuances of the policy detail that someone like Senator Gallagher is able to pull out in that kind of form, like, are not necessarily what Australians are interested in. And and the relationship has to work around, you know, when revelations come out of those particular environments, the media picks up on the things that they know that their audiences, their markets are interested in and what they want to hear. You can't actually force people to care about an issue that they don't care about. And in terms of looking at strategy, like there have been some, and I'm definitely going to write about this, there have been some moments this year where Labor have talked about really good policy, policy that benefits people, policy,
childcare,
you know, a national driver's license scheme, which is, these are all good ideas. But that's not what the conversation is about. And you can't force people into it.
And 2020 has really demonstrated that if you're in opposition, you've got to be talking to people where they're at.
Yeah.
You know? And you know, out of the 2019 election, there was a lot of that conversation about Labor had gone too far, too fast, and people weren't there, and that scared people. And now, it's not that people are scared, it's that people just don't tune in, right? And that's why I think the messages should be really simple. Morrison has failed. The Morrison government is not doing its job. You know, this Morrison attacked the Queensland government day after day after day for having its borders closed. Queensland's economy has recovered from COVID, essentially has recovered from COVID. They have more jobs now than they did before COVID. The WA economy,
booming.
You know, like these are situations that you would think, given the rhetoric of the Morrison government, could never happen. But the reality of it is Morrison failed. He failed the people in WA. He failed the people in Queensland. He's failing the people of New South Wales and Victoria.
He left the coronavirus response to the states. The only way that we got through it was because the premiers had the sense of, you know, a will to survive.
So the detail around which minister is failing at which part of their job is too detailed. Like, the reality is they're all failing. They're just failing.
And they're failing as Liberals. And this is the thing too. You know, it's another thing you and I talk about. People vote for brand.
Yeah.
People vote for party brand. And while we're talking about Richard Colbeck, we're not talking about the Liberal Party.
Yeah.
You know, because the thing is, there are a million Richard Colbecks. Richard Colbeck could be sucked up into the heavens by aliens, you know, aliens of very niche pursuits, tomorrow, and they would just replace him with another Tory who looked just like him, who would be just as unmemorable to the electorate as the rest of them.
That's right.
And, you know, they're
literally going through that process in WA replacing Cormann at the moment.
Yeah, where can we get another extremely dull conservative right-wing neoliberal who will absolutely stymie climate action and restrict the opportunity of Australians to experience empowerment in the workplace? Where can we get another just like that? And it's true, you know, like this is a political party that devolves to exactly two different kinds of hairstyle, and all genders are represented in that, well, obviously at differing proportions, in that particular visual frame. But this is the thing, you know, these sort of attacks on the individuals. The only individual that matters is Morrison, because Morrison's job is to carry the brand.
Yeah.
You know, and the problem is the Liberal Party. Like, they are just a self-perpetuation machine of Tory values and an uncaring attitude towards the actual lived material lives of the vast majority of Australians.
Yeah, because at the end of the day, you know, Van, I've been part of successful efforts to knock off particular ministers from their portfolios.
That's why I love you,
and
baby.
It's great fun, don't get me wrong, I enjoy it immensely. But at the end of the day, it doesn't change government. So, you know, let candidates at a local level fight candidates at a local level. And that does mean that in most cases, the safe seat ministers are not going to have a real competition. That's just the reality. But what we collectively need to do on the left, and those who oppose this kind of government, is oppose the flag bearer of the government, and that is the Prime Minister. He is the brand, he embodies the brand, and that's why he rolls out all the nasty announcements through all these no-name, white label, you know, men in boring suits.
The blue ties.
And quite frankly, forgettable women. It's amazing that there can be so few women in a caucus, yet have them be so forgettable. I just don't, you know, that's a quirk of the cloning machine, I guess, that they have in the Liberal Party.
Yeah, the Tory cloning machine. Boop.
Yeah,
haircut
right.
One. Boop. Haircut two.
That's boop. Right.
Haircut two. Boop.
So anyway, so 2020 has been a hell of a year. Lots of change. Lots of interesting things happened. 2021 is already sort of promising to be a little more normal. It looks like there'll be vaccines.
An election.
Yeah, it looks very much like there'll be an election. August is the sort of normal time frame. The start of time frame is August. There could be a double dissolution if the government decides it's going to manipulate a piece of legislation. And by the way, my money is still on that ominous omnibus IR Work Choices 2.0 bill being used as a double dissolution trigger. I hope I'm wrong. I hope we do end up having a normal election in sometime after August 2021, but it may be earlier. And look, we've just got to be ready, not just for an election, but for all the changes that are going to come. We're going to see another budget in May. There'll be more corporate tax cuts. There'll be more high-income earner tax cuts.
Economy's going badly. Cut corporate tax. Economy's going well. Cut corporate tax.
And
it's almost like there's a theme.
Well, there is a theme.
Do you pick up a theme? And yeah. If you can't cut corporate tax, just give $10 million to Australia's richest man.
Oh, yeah. Look,
or $30 million to News Limited. Why not? Cut the ABC, but give $30 million to News Limited.
And look, we haven't focused heavily on the sort of corruption of the Commonwealth government in this episode. We've talked about it a little bit in the past. I just want to quickly say on that, that one of the reasons why, you know, we're all very outraged about it, and rightly so. But one of the reasons they do it and one of the reasons they get away with it is that they lean into it. You know, they are damaged goods. When you're electing a Tory government, you expect that they're going to do these sorts of things. So reiterating that, oh, they've done these things that you sort of expect they'll do,
actually affirms their brand.
That's right.
Because it makes them recognisable. Yeah, well, you know, the Liberals are like, oh, yeah, they've always been friends at the big end of town.
So it's always interesting to me that that doesn't outrage more people. But I guess if you start from these are the ingredients, you can't be surprised when Coca-Cola has heaps of sugar in it, right?
No way. Coca-Cola's got sugar in it? Ben, I am so shocked.
Coca-Cola's got sugar. Tories are corrupt.
Next thing you'll be telling me that I probably shouldn't have had those 8 pavlovas last night. They were delicious.
Anyway, so let's move on to some good news because this is our final episode.
He sounds very sad, my Ben, and I just want you to know that he considers these subjects very deeply. I mean, we do this show and we do all the other stuff that we do because we're motivated by values which are about the communities we come from. You know, Ben and I grew up in working class families and experienced all kinds of marginalisation. And in my case, my dad being unemployed had a huge effect on me. And we've carried those values of a need to stick together, to survive, to fight for something better, to empower, like genuinely empower communities our whole lives. And talking about this stuff, you know, it does come at a psychological cost. Like, I understand why people want to tune out from politics because it's hard and it's frustrating. The more you know, you go, how can we beat these people? But the point is we can beat them.
Absolutely.
And we have in the past. And, you know, as an organised movement of working people, we change the very fabric of the world. And, you know, we connect to that. You know, we're part of a movement with our listeners and all of our comrades, you know, like across the trade union movement, in the activist community, people who are fighting for justice and equality and empowerment and all of those things.
Absolutely. And while I might sound sad and tired, it's only because I'm sad and tired, but I'm full of hope for the future. I actually believe fundamentally that there is a real hope for a better future because there are so many people committed to it, not just amongst our listener base and online, but in every community around this country. You know, I made an offhand comment in one episode about I'm sure nobody in the North Shore of Sydney is listening to us. And we had people from the North Shore of Sydney reach out to us and say, well, we love your show. Please don't think that we don't care just because we have some awful representatives in Parliament.
And I'd just like to say to those people, you made Ben's day.
Yeah, because the reality is there are good people in every community, regardless of who they might be represented by. And that fills me with a great sense of hope and optimism for the future because there are ideas out there and there are people prepared to put it on the line to make those ideas a reality that help people to build communities that leave us better off. And it has been that way since time immemorial, and it will be that way for all time to come. So I want to thank everybody for all of the work that you've put into 2020. I really hope that you have a really great break, a really great Christmas, and 2021, everybody comes back refreshed, everybody comes back ready to drive for that change, to drive for those positive outcomes, and to make Australia and the world the great, great shining beacon of working class
egalitarianism, prosperity and egalitarianism
that we know it can be.
That's inclusive. This time when we do egalitarianism, everybody gets included.
Everybody gets included.
Even women, even First Nations Australians.
Everybody.
Imagine. So
there's enough to go around.
There is enough to go around. Before I give my little bits of good news that I like to end on, we are going to take a 2-week break because we are, like everybody else, completely exhausted by this year. We would still love to hear from you. Obviously, our Twitter account and our Facebook account will keep going, and we'd love some suggestions of people who you might want us to interview, you know, prominent left-wing identities throughout the world. Give us a suggestion and we'll see what we can do. But and also things that you would like us to talk about more, that would be great. We love hearing from you all. And some of our best episodes have been on the basis of suggestions from that we've received from people. But just to give you some happy news, one, a family in England found 63 gold coins from the Tudor period in their backyard.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas, those guys, which is worth enormous amounts of money, as you can imagine, although they have handed them over to the British Museum. They are part of a community of 6,500 British households who, since the pandemic began, have dug up treasures basically around their house, like finding things in the walls or in the backyard or in the shed. I'm going to show just how many households tasks people were putting off before the pandemic. So one of the good things about the pandemic is, like, it's a golden age for
treasure hunters
and the discovery of antiquity. 6,500 households, and they're the ones who contacted the British Museum, who said, "I think I've got something interesting in my yard." They were like digging up pieces of Roman furniture, the most incredible stuff.
Boris Johnson's new UK economic stimulus plan is dig for treasure in your garden.
Yeah that's nice. To be fair, Ben, that's a lot more comprehensive than Boris Johnson has managed
so
in some time. So that's one piece of good news. The other piece of good news is Tesco. This is on my obsessive subject. You should see the look on Ben's face whenever I bring this up, which is probably why I keep doing it. Tesco, which is the third biggest grocery chain in the world, eliminated 20 million pieces of single-use plastic from its Christmas catalogue this year, basically its Christmas sales. And they're working out how to reduce, reuse, recycle, and create opportunities to minimise single-use plastic in their system, which is great, which makes me happy given my plastic obsession and the nightmares I have about oceans overrunning with plastic bags. And the third thing, which I think is really fantastic, we hear obviously a lot of bad news out of Russia, given that assassination attempts on political enemies thing, and infiltration of American government at the highest level, and all those computers they hacked throughout the American government, which is kind of a problem.
And that their only exports are oil, gas, and vodka. Yep.
Yeah. All of these things, but some good news out of Russia and other Eastern European countries is that over the past few decades, aggressive conservation efforts have rebuilt the population of European bison, which is really exciting. So 50 years ago, there were only 50 bison left. They were all in captivity, and conservationists have refused to give in, and working across Russia, the Ukraine, Romania, like all of these countries that generally when we hear news about them in the West it is generally sad or bad. Yeah. And yeah, so conservation efforts in Eastern Europe, there are now 6,500 bison.
Wow, that's amazing, isn't it? That's fantastic.
It is. It's really, I love that kind of news.
Yeah, that's great. I think that's really great, and it's nice that bison, they're not quite reindeer, but it's an almost Christmas animal, isn't it, for bison? So I think in honour of the bison being our new Christmas animal here at The Week on Wednesday, again, I just want to thank everybody. This is The Week on Wednesday. It has been The Week on Wednesday. We've done 18 episodes in a row.
Amazing.
I want to thank everybody, I want to thank you, Van, for your sterling efforts throughout the year.
Benjamin, the fact that 18 episodes ago you didn't even know how to turn on my computer and now you can edit a show and use an app that still confounds me. I love this man, listeners. I just think he's the most superb person and I love saying that in public because I just think he's great. And the fact that, you know, we kept ourselves going in this pandemic by doing a podcast in our shed with our dog to talk about the things that obsess us has been a real balm. It's been a balm.
And I want to thank Germanicus as well. Hopefully you heard Germanicus in the background throughout the show. He's been very barky today. He is very excited for Christmas. His grandmother Barb is here with us for another couple of weeks as well. And listeners, we appreciate all the love that you've given to us, but particularly you have given to Germanicus over the year or over the last 18 weeks. And just so that you know, some of you will be aware that he did hurt himself on the weekend. He is making a very nice recovery. Thank you very much. His leg is almost fully recovered from his minor injury.
He's currently trotting down our driveway and it is too cute for words.
Too cute for words. So have a very Merry Christmas. Have a Happy New Year.
Happy holidays, whatever.
Happy Hanukkah.
Yo Festivus. Cool, yeah. Yule.
Kwanzaa, I think, is a thing.
Yep. Certainly to all my Jewish friends who are lighting up my Twitter feed with the menorah as part of Hanukkah, like, have a great holiday season. Whoever you are, wherever you are, whatever you celebrate, celebrate it beautifully.
If spirituality isn't your thing, then just enjoy Paul Kelly's gravy song, as I'm sure so many Australians will, this Christmas, December 25th. Thanks very much. Love you, Vanny.
Oh, I adore you, Benny.
Bye.
Bye.